In Mistaken Identity, a 1990 episode of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Philip and Vivian take a helicopter to a vacation in Palm Springs, leaving Will and Carlton to drive the failing Mercedes down to the resort town. After officers pull them over for what Will describes as DWB, or driving while black, they accuse them of a rash of car thefts in the area. After being unable to get their parents to corroborate their story, Will and Carlton are thrown in jail, prompting Will to concoct one of his famous schemes. He'll confess to the carjackings in the condition that the confession is filmed, with the hope that Vivian and Philip will see the broadcast and intervene.
The ringleader agreed to confess only if a camera crew were present to broadcast live. What you are about to see is a Minuteman 21 news exclusive.
Yeah, we done it! Word to Big Bird. We fixed 8 Benzitos, 15 Jags, and a Maserati. But I ain't like the upholstery, so I took it back. Jack!
Of course, the gambit works, and Will and Carlton are freed, a result you're much likelier to see in Tinseltown instead of the West Philadelphia streets where Will Smith was born and raised. On those streets, a false confession will lead to a life sentence, not a laugh track, and it's one that later backtracking is unlikely to undo.
On Monday, August 19, 1991, 21-year-old Chester Holman III spent much of his day in Delaware, visiting his parents and girlfriend before heading back in the evening to Philadelphia, where he shared an apartment with a roommate. For the previous 2 years, he worked as a guard for Brooks Armored Car Service, driving around most days with millions of dollars and picking up and dropping off huge packages of cold hard cash from vaults and money rooms in businesses across Philadelphia. On any other Monday, he would have been at work. But this Monday was his first day of vacation from work, and in fact, his first vacation ever. That morning, he had deposited his paycheck and an extra check of $500 that he borrowed from his employer, thinking that he might need a little extra cash to enjoy his week off. Chester was excited to start his vacation, but after a day of visiting family in the suburbs and doing some shopping, he was just a little bored. So he made some phone calls from his parents' house between 10:45 p.m. and 11:20 p.m. and then figured Philadelphia would probably have more going on. So he headed out about 10 minutes later, at 11:30, after saying his goodbyes to his parents and sister. Once on the road, he stopped in the city of Chester, to the southwest of Philadelphia, to get a burger, fill up the gas tank, and grab a fruit punch Gatorade. He ate and drank as he drove, and after finishing, he stuffed the balled-up burger wrapper back in the bag along with the receipt and tossed it at a site somewhere in the car. By the time he got back to Philadelphia, it was around 12:15 a.m. There, he saw Deirdre Jones, a young woman who lived in the same building as him, walking along the road with her sister, Tiffany. He pulled over, calling out to them, but they ignored him at first because they didn't recognize the car. He had a nice ride for that day, a white Chevy Blazer, but it wasn't his Blazer, actually. It was his roommate's, who said he could borrow it while he was out of town. He could have taken his own car, but why put extra mileage on it? Besides, his 1984 Toyota Celica wasn't nearly as impressive as the gleaming new truck. After the girls realized it was Chester waving at them from the big white Blazer, he parked behind their building and went around to the front of the apartments where Deirdre and Tiffany were now chatting with a couple of guys. Chester hung out and chatted with them for a few minutes, and then he headed inside. And as he swiped his key card, he realized Deirdre had snuck up behind him, saying that she wanted to hang out. So he suggested going for a ride in the city, and she agreed, but first they had to pop into his apartment so he could drop off his overnight bag. Chester was in the bedroom when he heard Deirdre shout from his living room to someone below. It was Carol McCoy, who lived two floors below him, and she was shouting right back up from her own window. They decided to give Carol a quick visit before going for their ride. Back down in the parking lot, Chester asked Deirdre if she wanted to drive the Blazer, but she said no, she didn't actually know how to drive. So Chester got in the driver's seat and suggested that they go visit a friend in Southwest, thinking he should definitely be home that late at night. It was close to 1 a.m. Chester and Deirdre lived in an apartment building on Broad Street in Philadelphia, a main thoroughfare that runs north to south through the city, and they needed to head southwest to get to his friend's place. So they took a right onto Broad Street, southbound, all the way down to Lombard Street, a little over 2 miles away. There, they hung a left and went about 5 blocks before a couple of police cars pulled up behind them, with their lights flashing. Chester immediately pulled to the side, with two cop cars surrounding him. He knew things were serious, and this was no routine traffic stop, when two Philadelphia police officers approached the car, holding guns aimed right at him. Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, the State versus Chester Holman. My name is Rabia Chaudhary. I'm an attorney and author, and I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Hi, I'm Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Just last week, I had to get a really important package mailed out, like, immediately. But the day got away from me, like it does for so many of us, and I just couldn't make it to the post office in time. Lucky for me, I have Stamps.com, and my package did get sent out, because Stamps brings all the amazing services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your computer. All you have to do is use your own computer to print official U.S. postage for any letter or package, any class of mail, and you just let the mailman pick it up right from your home or business. You never have to leave your home or business. No more lugging mail anywhere, no more hassle, no more worrying about hours. You know, imagine all the things you can do at the same time if you use Stamps.com. It saves you time and money because everything you can do at the post office, almost everything you can do right from your desk. And Stamps.com has postage discounts that you actually can't get at the post office. And they make it really easy because Stamps.com sends you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage. And no, it's nothing like those super expensive postage meters. It is a fraction of the cost. You will never overpay or underpay for postage again either. I know I've done that. I've ended up putting up too many stamps or not enough stamps. And well, I never have to get it wrong now that I have Stamps.com. So create your Stamps.com account in minutes online with no equipment to lease and no long-term commitments. It is convenient, it is easy, it is reliable and efficient. I use Stamps.com because I need to save time and money and energy in my life. And right now you too can enjoy Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. You ready for a happier, more efficient, easier new year? Well, go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Undisclosed. That's Stamps.com, and enter Undisclosed.
My name is Chester Holman, III. I'm 47 years old. I was arrested on August 19th, 1991. I've been incarcerated now. I'm going into my 27th year.
Chester had no way of knowing the night he was pulled over that he would never see freedom again. He was, in fact, fairly confident that this was just all a mistake. It had to be. Whatever it was the police thought he did, though, he knew he hadn't done anything wrong. Other than one minor altercation in a bar, the result of an alcohol-induced poor decision-making, he'd had a clean record. And some years of college under his belt already, a good job, money in the bank. Besides, he could pretty much account for his day and that evening on August 19th. So whatever it was they thought he'd done, they were wrong. He and Deirdre got out of the car and answered the questions being shot at them. Where were they coming from? Where were they going? Chester's heart was pounding. He was terrified. It's not that he hadn't ever been around a gun before. In fact, he'd had a gun issued to him by his work, but having loaded weapons pointed at him, pointed right at you, that's a different thing altogether. And then Chester heard a police dispatcher say that the suspects were wanted back at the scene of the crime. He had no idea what crime scene they were talking about. The officers finished up searching his car, where they found his Brooks Armored Car service work ID, and they also found a hunting knife and a baseball bat. Although those weren't his, they were his roommate's. Chester and Deirdre were cuffed, put in separate cars, and then taken, along with the white blazer, down to the corner of Chestnut and 22nd Street, where Tae Jung Ho had been shot and killed less than 10 minutes earlier.
So we got there, and when we pulled up, it was like maybe two or three police cars, I think it was, some, maybe four or five witnesses out under under the streetlight. So Deidre, the car Deidre was in, she was ahead of me in the van. The Blazer was ahead of them. So they came back to me, officer opened up the car, and the witnesses looked in. And there's only one witness that looked in, and that was a black guy. And that I found out later was Andre Dawkins. He looked in. He said, "I'm not sure if that's the guy." He said, "Where's the other guy? I know what the other guy looks like." So I made sure I stuck my head out again to make sure everybody could see me. He said, "That's not him." So they closed the door, and they went up and did the same thing with Deidre. I watched everybody go up and look at the Blazer.
This is a call from Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution. Retreat. This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
The phone system at the prison, by the way, is set up so that this annoying message interrupts your conversation every 5 minutes, as if anyone would forget who they're talking to. Anyway, back to Chester.
And from there, we went to, I don't know what precinct it was, but I think it was a district. We got to the district, well, I did. I got to the district. They put me in the cell. By the time I got in the cell, I heard they said that the guy had died.
So Chester sat, cuffed to a chair that was bolted to the floor, waiting for something to happen, someone to come talk to him. And someone did. A detective who walked in about 20 minutes later with a notepad in his hand. He leaned over Chester and asked him a single question. "Oh, you like killing people, huh?" Punched him in the mouth, and then walked away. Then, 10 minutes later, the same detective came back into the room and started questioning Chester as if nothing had happened before, as if he hadn't just punched a handcuffed man in the face. When the interrogation began, Chester did what most 21-year-olds would do. He asked for his parents. He was told the phone was tied up at the moment, though. So Chester began answering general questions, ever so often stopping to request a phone call. But over the next couple of hours, the rotating slew of officers and detectives who came in and out of the room all told him the same thing. The phones weren't available. For hours and hours, not a single phone was available for him to make a call. At one point, Chester's heart lifted because two familiar faces came into the room. The heads of security at Brooks, both of the men being ex-state troopers. He was friendly with them and thought this was a good sign, but when they had a seat with him, they grilled him in the same way. Was his service revolver involved in the crime, they asked. Chester, of course, responded that he hadn't done anything. He wasn't involved in any crime. He tried to convince the two men that the police had it all wrong, but his heart broke when one of the men told him it was just better for him to cooperate because he was in serious trouble. Chester was stunned, and as they left, he asked if they would contact his parents for him. They said they would, but they never did. Instead, Chester was interrogated for nearly 7 hours, at least that's how long he thinks it was, and during that time, he never spoke to his parents or a lawyer. It wasn't until around 9 or 10 a.m. the next day that he finally spoke to his mother, who had already heard about his arrest in the news, and who assured him they were working to get him an attorney as soon as possible. But in the meantime, the police already had a 9-page record of questioning Chester. According to the police report, the interrogation began at 4 a.m. and was conducted by Detective Jeff Pyrie.
A 1970 article in the New York Times titled "The War of the Cops" chronicled the violence against Philadelphia police officers by black militants in an in-depth long-form piece that explored, quote, the long-standing bitterness of the urban ghetto toward the men in blue. At the time, 24-year-old officer Jeff Pyrie, who spent most of his time patrolling West Philly, was profiled in the piece. Pyrie, you see, had ulcers at his tender age thanks to both his job and his personality. The article noted, quote, "He looks for trouble and he loves to find it. He chases people down dark alleys. He will frisk a man on the street if he sees him flinch at the sight of a patrol car or notices him walking stiff-armed, as if he might be concealing a sawed-off shotgun under his jacket. He has had guns pointed at him half a dozen times. This year, he had an arm slashed while fighting a knife-wielding junkie. Last year, he wrestled a man with a gun and ended the match by forcing his opponent to shoot himself in the chest. I'm gung-ho," he admits. "I love being on the highway patrol. I deplore violence, but if we have to have it, then I want some of it." Pyrie certainly did want some of it the night Chester Holman was detained. He was the one who had begun the night by punching Chester in the mouth.
Chester's interrogation, at least as it reads on paper, started with questions about who Chester was with when he was pulled over that night. "Deirdre," he responds. "Well, okay, but who were you with before the cops stopped you?" he was asked. "Nobody," Chester tells them. He is asked about who was driving, and of course he was. And he's asked about if anyone else had been driving before him. Remember, most of the eyewitnesses to the crime had seen a young black woman driving the white Chevy Blazer. and they'd seen two men involved. Pyrie was trying to figure out where the other perps were. Chester is asked if he was ever in the rear of the car, or entered from the rear door. No, he said. And then they asked about the car itself, the white four-door S10 Chevy Blazer. Chester says it's not his, it's his roommate's. It's Sean Boyce's, who'd lent it to him that morning. Although actually it's not even his roommate's car, it's a rental from Alamo. And Boyce, ironically, used to work at the budget car rental place until getting fired. But he had the Chevy and a second car, a Cadillac, from Alamo, and had taken the other car on a trip to New York earlier the previous day, leaving the truck with Chester. Boyce had been dating a girl named Sharon who was working at Alamo, and Chester thought, but wasn't entirely sure, that both of the cars were inventory stolen from the rental company. Pyrie then moved on to the weapon. Did Chester own a gun? Well, he did, but it wasn't his personal weapon. It was a service revolver, a .38, that he didn't carry with him when he wasn't on duty. That, along with the bulletproof vest, were both back in his apartment. And what about his clothes? Pyrie asked. What had he and Deirdre been wearing before the police stopped them? Did they have any other clothes with them in the vehicle? No, they didn't, and they hadn't changed all night. Detective's notes show that Chester had on a white t-shirt that said, "He's not heavy, he's my brother," written on it. And also was wearing aqua green sweatpants, a dark baseball cap, white Fila sneakers, and a diamond stud in his left ear. In his pocket, he had $37. During the interview, Pyrie noted that Chester's t-shirt had a faint red stain on it. Chester was asked, "You have what appears to be blood in your right sleeve. Can you explain that stain?" Chester's one-word response is written down as, "No." Pyrie asks again when and how Chester met up with Deirdre, and if anyone else was with them, or if they had picked up any hitchhikers. Chester insisted, no, it was just us. And one of the very last questions Chester has asked is whether they were in the area of Chestnut and 22nd at all that night. Once again, Chester says no. The interview ends there, with a note from Pyrie.
"At this time, I showed Chester Holman three pages of a statement by Deirdre Jones. He read the three pages and then stated, 'I don't want to say any more. I told that bitch to keep her mouth shut. Shit.'"
We're never going to agree on everything, but I think we can all agree we could all use more sleep. Getting a great night's sleep is easier and more affordable than you think. You don't need a new expensive mattress or sleeping pills. You just need to change your sheets. That's why you should check out Bull & Branch. Everything Bull & Branch makes, from bedding to blankets, is made from pure 100% organic cotton, which means they start out super soft and they get even softer over time. I can say I've been using Bull & Branch sheets for the past year, and in fact, they're the softest sheets I've ever had, and they have in fact gotten softer over time. They always help me get a great night's sleep. And the great thing about Bull & Branch is you buy directly from them, so you're essentially paying wholesale prices. Luxury sheets can cost up to $1,000 in stores, but Bull & Branch sheets are only a couple hundred bucks. Everyone who tries Bull & Branch sheets loves them. That's why they have thousands of five-star reviews. And Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, and Fast Company are all talking about Bull & Branch. Even three U.S. presidents sleep on Bull & Branch sheets. Shipping is free, and you can try them for 30 nights. If you don't love them, send them back for a full refund. But I doubt you want to send them back. There's no risk and no reason not to give them a try. To get you started, right now my listeners can get $50 off your first set of sheets at bullandbranch.com, promo code undisclosed. So go to bullandbranch.com today for $50 off your first set of sheets. That's B-O-L-L and branch.com, promo code undisclosed. BowlandBranch.com, promo code undisclosed.
Twenty-year-old Deirdre Jones sat in another room in the police administration building with Detective David Baker. The record of the interview begins at 2:30 a.m. with Deirdre signing off on her Miranda warnings and then telling the detective, quote, in her own words, what had brought her there that night.
"Will you go on in your own words and tell me what happened that brings you here today?"
"Well, we were driving, me and Chester. Me and Chester was driving down. I don't know the name of this street. And we was pulled over by the police, and they told us to get out of the car, and they asked me where was the gun. I said, 'I don't know what you're talking about.' And then they said, 'Where are the people that you were with?' Then I said, I don't know what you're talking about. We were by ourselves. Then they put the handcuffs on me, and then they took us to this other block. I don't know the name of it. And this man came up. He just walked past the car. He didn't even look in the car. And then he flagged his hand and said, yeah, that's her. But he really didn't look in the car.
We don't have the audio of the interview, though we know it was recorded, and that's unfortunate because it could really help explain how Deirdre started off her interrogation by stating when she pulled over, she didn't know why or what was going on, to a totally different story in the very next question.
Will you start at the beginning and tell me how you got in the vehicle and what happened from the time you got in the vehicle?
I was home. Chester came past. He had his friends in the car, and he said, come on, let's go somewhere. And I said, okay, since Tiffany is with her boyfriend, I'll go because I'm bored. When I got in, I said, where are we going? And he, Chester, said, oh, just anywhere. We're just going to go riding. And I said, okay. Then we drove around a little bit. He was still saying, where do you want to go? And I was like, well, I said, I really don't know my way around, and if I say, I'll get lost. Then he said, do you want to drive? And I said, no, because I can't see without my glasses. Plus, I can't drive. Then we got into Center City. Whatever the block was, the girl stopped. Well, I didn't tell you about that. Chester, when he asked me if I wanted to drive, and I said no, he asked the girl that was with us if she wanted to drive, and she said, yeah, I'll drive. And that's when we went into Center City, and that's when they got to the block where we stopped, and Chester and the guy started plotting on this guy. They was talking about getting this guy for his stuff, and I was telling them no, that I wanted to go home. Then this guy in a green shirt said to Chester and the guy, they was getting out of the Jeep, yo, don't mess with him. They got out and, like, rushed him anyway. Chester was, like, in the side, and the other guy was in the front. Then I heard a gunshot. The other guy was, like, blocking the front, so I couldn't see who did the shooting. So then they ran back to the front, and I couldn't see who did the shooting. So then they ran back to the Jeep. Chester jumped in the back window, and the other guy got in the door, and the girl took off. Then we drove, I don't know where. When we got to wherever, we got the girl and guy got out, and I told Chester I wanted to go home. Then we was going around this block, and I thought Chester was taking me home. Then we got stopped by the cops.
Deirdre goes on to describe two other people in the car, a medium-built, brown-skinned young man with a dark hoodie and high-top sneakers, and a young black woman with shoulder-length hair, swirly earrings, a t-shirt, and sweatpants. She says she doesn't know their names, though. She tells the police the music was up so high that she couldn't hear them. Deirdre states that Chester was driving at first, but then he switched with the other woman, and when they got into Center City, the district in which Tae Jung Ho was killed, the man in the hoodie began plotting to get somebody to rush someone and rob them. This part of the conversation apparently wasn't hindered by the music, and Deirdre protested, saying she didn't want any part of it, and she asked to be taken home. Deirdre then says that they spotted Tae Jung and decided on rushing him, so the girl driving backed up the car from the corner they were at, presumably Chestnut and 22nd. The guys got out. She heard a shot and saw someone fall. Then the two men came running back to the car and they drove off, stopping after a few minutes, whereupon the other woman and the hooded man got out of the car. She estimated where they got out of the car because she didn't know the exact location, but it was about 4 minutes before they were pulled over by the police.
Deirdre's statement matches up pretty well with what the police already knew happened based on reports of witnesses. But there are inconsistencies, because after Deirdre is reminded of the police about the visit to Chester's apartment, she adds this fact to her statement, but she says that Chester then left the apartment, she went back outside, and Chester finally returned with friends in his car. She also says that he has friends in his car the second time he picked her up. Although a few questions earlier, she had said that the first time he drove up to her, his friends were already in the car. Later on in questioning, Deirdre adds a few very important details, like how they stopped at a gas station and she stayed in the car with the other female while the two men got out and wandered around and then got back in the truck after 15 minutes. They drove around a bit more and then came back to the same gas station again, which is when the men got out once more and attacked the victim. Deirdre's story has nearly completely changed by this point, but it should sound familiar. A white car at a gas pump that drove off and then came back to the same pump. That's the same story that two other witnesses gave police, Joseph Cabin and Andre Dawkins. Remember them? That's the guy at the telephone booth and the guy who was cleaning up in the parking lot that night. Deirdre's interview ends with this question. Is everything you told me the truth, and did anyone force you to make this statement? She answers, yes, it's the truth, and no, she was not forced.
This is the 9-page statement that was then walked over to Chester Holman and shown to him. A confession by his friend, who he had already admitted was with him that night. And it was after seeing this statement, as noted on the bottom of Chester's own statement that he allegedly said, "I told that bitch to keep her mouth shut."
Are you hiring? Posting your position to job sites and waiting, and waiting for the right people to see it? ZipRecruiter knew there was a smarter way, so they built a platform that finds the right job candidates for you. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. These invitations have revolutionized how you find your next hire. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate to the site in just one day. And ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They even spotlight the strongest applications you receive so you never miss a great match. The right candidates are out there, and ZipRecruiter is how you find them. Businesses of all sizes trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. That's ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. The bottom of Chester's statement also notes that after seeing the signed confession by Deirdre, he said he didn't want to talk anymore. And he didn't. There's no confession by Chester. Ever. In fact, he has maintained his innocence to his attorneys and family and friends all these years. There was one more confession, though. This was by Tiffany Jones, Deirdre's sister. About 12 hours after her sister confessed, 17-year-old Tiffany is questioned by the police. Her story goes as follows. Tiffany saw Chester earlier in the evening, the night of the murder, around 7 or 8 p.m., while she was out shopping with her sister. Chester was driving in a white Jeep of some kind. She saw him again around 10:30 p.m. that night, at the front of their apartment building, and said both times he seemed mopey and sad. She said Deirdre and Chester then went into the building together, and she didn't see them for the rest of the night. One of the detectives questioning her says, "Tiffany, I believe you're telling a lie. Isn't it a fact that you were with Chester and your sister in the white vehicle?" Tiffany responds, "No. It isn't a fact." A couple pages later, she says the next time she heard from her sister was when she got a call at 9 a.m. from the police station when Deirdre told her everything, that Chester had two other people with him, and they had a plan, and she was scared but couldn't leave, and Chester told her what to say to the police, which is mostly like what is contained in Deirdre's confession. But then Tiffany is pressed again by the detective. Twice. "Tiffany, please tell me what really happened, okay?"
And Tiffany does. She confesses to being with her sister and Chester that night, admitting that she was the second female in the car. She describes Chester and a second man, one she thinks was named Troy, get out and kill Taejung, and then take off in the Jeep, and then stop somewhere where Troy got out, and she got out too, leaving her sister behind. That is where the statement, which is typewritten, ends. But there is a handwritten line on the very bottom, one that is then furiously crossed out. But I managed to make out what it said underneath. "This story is a lie. Initialed TJ, Tiffany Jones." And it was a lie. It was all a lie. Which is why, years later, Deirdre came forward to say this.
"I was forced under threat of my personal safety to testify in a murder trial. The defendant in the trial was Chester Holman III. The trial took place in the Philadelphia court of common pleas in 1993 in regard to the murder that took place in 1991 in Philadelphia. My testimony was forced, inaccurate, and given under duress."
Next time on Undisclosed. A big thank you and shout out to Celeste Trusty, who is an assistant producer and lead investigator on this case with me, and also to Zachary Stern with the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. Thank you for all the work you've done in helping us research this case. Thank you to Mito Telhan, our executive producer, to Baluki for our fabulous new logo and branded graphics. A big thanks to all of our sponsors who keep us on the air. And of course, a big thanks to the person who keeps us sounding good, our audio producer extraordinaire, Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and host of the podcast Crime Writers On and HGTV and me. Make sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is @UndisclosedPod, and you can use the tag UD Addendum to tag us in questions for every week's addendum. Thanks so much for listening.